Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO and founder of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Sid Mason. Sid is a co-founder and CEO of Wokolo AI. Sid, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Christian. Excited.
Yeah, likewise. So let's jump into it. Let's start with Wokolo AI. What problem is it solving in the marketplace?
Sure, of course. We are solving a problem that I faced myself as a young management consultant and then a investor in corporate development capacity. Wokolo is an agentic AI platform that helps you automate large data set problems for consulting, for private equity, for banking. Specifically, we automate company diligence, sector research, market mapping, helping automate end-to-end workflows for our customers, right? All the way till creating end deliverables in well-formatted PowerPoint decks. So that's really the problem. The grunt work that is entailed in creating a research collateral, but also the fear of, you know, leaving insights to the table. So Wokolo does not only just solve for grunt work, but helps you get or extract unique differentiated insights from a large variety of data scattered both, you know, whether it's public or proprietary to you. So that's what we're solving for.
Wow. And so, you know, for the members of our audience who are not as familiar in asset management, due diligence is a big part of making decisions. And as you pointed out, you know, some things, you know, humans, as we tend to do, can overlook something, and artificial intelligence has the opportunity to address it. But we also know that, you know, there's risk involved as well with investing in any asset class. And so how do you guys think about risk? You know, it's one thing to streamline workflows. It's another thing, as you point out, to ensure that you have a clear picture of an asset class. But I would imagine that this is core to the offering.
Absolutely. I think that's a important question, because right now the whole conversation, the whole narrative is very much skewed in favor of what's good, what's interesting, how will this show a hockey stick kind of curve, right? But I think of late, because of AI, a lot of people tend to just think about the implications of AI in a negative way, in that form of risk, but just in form of doing due diligence, where private equity funds or even strategic sponsors are looking to invest in companies, risk is one of the most important aspects, right? The way we look at it is to provide our end users with an all-rounded view. Your risk signal could be coming in from just not the background or reference checks, but it could also come in from a, you know, seemingly innocuous comment made on social media by the founder. It could come in from how the users are perceiving your platform. And those signals propagate over a period of time. One might find it in places like Reddit or a software review website like or a G2 or a Capterra. So there are a lot of unconventional sources of risk, which is what we are trying to solve for beyond the traditional ones, where we pick up signals from noise and help our customers get like much more awareness from an all-rounded view, whether it's product, whether it's IP, whether it's tech, whether it's management team risk and so on. So I think where platforms like ours can really add value, and that's how we think very carefully about risk, is one, are we able to give our customers additional insight from sources that they would have not thought about, right? Second, and this is not exactly a risk, but one of the downsides or one of the implications of using AI, there could be certain interpretation issues many a times where we think something is positive, but it's like really, really not the right way to think about it. So how can we give our end users the ability to combine market validation with expert calls with what the management has to say, right? So you think of it like these three different sources of information coming through: what your management team is telling you, Second, what is the voice of the journalist or the market or news that is the pulse that we can get from the public domain? And lastly, how can we, marry that with the expert interviews, whether it's customer reference calls and so on? And triangulating these three things together, looking for conflicting, contradictory data is often the most interesting to highlight those areas of risk.
And so, how many years has Wokalo been in
We've
existence?
been around, yeah, we've been around for 2.5 years.
Okay.
We started almost a year before ChatGPT came out, so we definitely were building it much before the hype cycle started on GenAI. And really bringing into practice the learnings we as co-founders, and of course through acquired learnings and feedback from our initial customers, trying to blend that into the platform.
And how has the current version, current market version evolved since day one?
Oh, a lot, a lot. Our very first product feature was a company diligence. Right. We thought that was one of the most recurring high volume use case for a lot of different personas. So we started with that, keeping what will be the demand from the market, which was a good start. But I think right now, from being a one single feature product oriented company to now a platform, it's come a long way. Right. So giving our users the ability to not just use a very cookie cutter kind of an output, but instead curate it, customize it to their unique needs, giving them a no code interface for building their own agents, which really unlocks a lot of value, right? Now you could use the building blocks that Wokalo has developed beyond just company diligence to sector research, to market mapping, to portfolio monitoring, to creating your deliverables, whether it's a SIM for investment bank and so on. So a lot of those avenues have been opened up, and a lot of that engineering effort has gone behind pulling in alternative data sets, especially for private markets where we specialize. So the platform and the whole product features come a long way. We've also had a lot of learnings, right? Like we realized that you cannot be a specialist in both public and private markets at the same time. You need to start with your beachhead. So we, of course, have in our past lives faced difficulties with the dealing with private market data. A lot of people don't understand the immense value that is lying unlocked in just public data sets for private companies, right? It could be a podcast like this, right? So focusing more on the private markets, expanding the offering to spread across the entire deal lifecycle, right from sourcing, screening, diligence, all the way to monitoring and exit management, is where our customers have been, asking us to come up with features. So it's been an interesting journey where we've been trying to navigate what our customers are asking for, yet having a very opinionated outlook in terms of what the roadmap should look like. And many of times these would conflict with each other, and but that's what the fun is. How can you figure out where the customers and value is being created, and how can you drive the product in that direction? So short answer is that we've evolved from a single product or single feature platform to a agentic platform where customers can build their own agents. And it's from a technical stack perspective, Wokalo brings in a full stack layout, which includes not only the infrastructure layer through our partners, but the middleware is all provided by us. The application layer, middleware, together, stacked together, are provided by Wokalo. And our customers come in, infuse their own frameworks, their own methodologies. And that is where it, gets very valuable for them because they have hundreds of other tools to kind of, look and work with. But none of them kind of adapt to their own unique processes. And that's what the secret sauce is, right? Rather than having to adapt to what AI has to say, why can't you use it or craft it in a way that it is still aligned with your ways of doing business? So it's been an interesting journey in that regard.
And so was that your co-founder and your philosophy from day one, or have you found that the product roadmap has evolved over the last couple of years?
I would say we've stuck to nearly 70 to 80% of the roadmap we had envisioned for the next couple of years. And the 20% has been a lot of learnings, a lot of counterintuitive insights that we've actually got working with the customers. For instance, we thought portfolio monitoring or comparative monitoring, real-time use cases will not be very important, but it turns out that as more and more AI tools proliferate, people are getting lazier and they would not want to come to a platform and generate reports. They just want the AI to know when you need that information and hit it in your inbox at the right time. So it's been those kind of things which have been very fascinating, which we had never imagined or envisioned when we started the firm.
Well, a bunch more questions to ask the company and the product. Before we do, would love to know what your career progression looked like leading up to Wokolo, and what did you learn along the way that helped inform how you think about running the company today?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I can provide you a brief background, right, which will probably set the stage. So both of us co-founders actually have a very similar background, right? We both started our careers as management consultants, and both of us then also crossed paths in the same firm in corporate development for Tata Group. So both of us have had consulting and investment experience. Interestingly, we got a little tired of building PowerPoint decks and not really seeing execution of many of the strategies that we would propose, and that led to a lot of like discontent, right, with our roles. And we both, in our own little ways, tried to pivot our careers toward building product or tech. I pursued a master's in AI. I became the head of product for an IoT platform for the federal government. My co-founder was heading natural language processing for an insurtech giant, right? Actually, insurtech for AIG, which is one of the largest insurance companies out there. So that was the backdrop. And when we came across generative AI as a technology, the very initial versions of GPT-2 and 3 itself are very promising, which made us think that, hey, there's a large upside in terms of really this transition that we commonly refer to as services to software. And although this term is new, but that's really what, really stuck with us, that a lot of professional services can be made a lot more efficient by using a platform that we wanted to build. Fast forward now, right? I think there were a lot of failures in my past career that I can talk about that helped me specifically in shaping what Vocado is. In my very first experience as a product manager, I took up a role within consulting, within Deloitte, which was a little frowned upon for a strategy consultant to take up a tech project back in the day. But thank God that I did it, right? It gave me that first exposure to building a product. But it failed miserably because of two things. One, there was no stakeholder alignment in terms of the rollout from top down. But secondly, which I take the blame on myself, was a terrible user interface. We probably had the most clunky interface in my very first version of an analytics tool that we were building. So the product went nowhere. It was a feature for one of the larger telcos that, obviously didn't have much traction, but was immensely helpful for me as a person learning from that failure. I call that out is because when we started Vocado, it's a new category, right? We're using AI, building AI agents to do the work of humans. No, the jury's still out on what is the right business model. Do you charge based on licenses or seats? The user interface is going to be very different. Do you use a similar interface like ChatGPT? And mind you, we didn't even have ChatGPT when we started. We just had APIs from GPT-3. To building a workflow-based agent that we have in Vocado right now. And one of the most important things was, while you can get the data right, the synthesis right, the analysis right, the modeling right, maybe even the accuracy to 100% with zero hallucinations, one thing that really stands out is the end experience. How can it be simple? How can it be intuitive for a new category? You just can't try out very fancy things at get-go for a new category of software. And I think that was one of my biggest learnings from a prior experience that has helped shape Vocado from a roadmap, from the design principles perspective. The second thing that has helped shape Vocado, which I think has been more of a hybrid work culture, it's not fully remote, it's not fully in person. And that's really owing to the nature of how we got started, right? We still am in Seattle, but my co-founder's in Bangalore, and we were exchanging notes. And then when you're looking for the right talent for your first engineer, for your first VP of engineering, because we were already kind of scattered at different time zones, it just made natural sense for us to hire the best talent available, right? Now, the downside is you don't get in-person time, but the upside is that your talent pool opens to the whole world. I'm very old school, so I still prefer very much in-person office setup. But this was just post-COVID. People still wanted to be working from home. We started off at different locations, and organically the team was built as virtual, which was scattered across US and India largely. But over a period of time, as we, the team grew beyond 8 team members, we realized that it's important for everybody to meet, to just spend time with each other. And that's when we made it a point that every 2 to 3 months, the entire team will get together in a single location, co-work for 1 entire week, and call it co-working hackathons, or call it a bit of an offsite towards the end of it, just for people to build that rapport. That has served us well. Of course, both approaches have their upside and downside, but I think both from a platform perspective, design principles perspective, from a user interaction, as well as just the whole work culture that is being shaping up, these have been the two pivotal decisions for us, to be honest.
You mentioned UX, and my position has always been it's central to user adoption. Did you self-teach yourself, or did you realize that you needed to go out and hire some world-class UX professionals?
So that's something me and my co-founder debated a lot initially. And I think we've come to a conclusion that if you're building something net new, because the business aspect of it, the product aspect of it is only in your brains, right? It's only the two of you or the three of you, how many of your co-founders you are. For that to be translated in the form of interaction is something which I still feel should be done by founders, right? As a very V1 first version. Now, polishing it, using some best practices of design components to make it slightly better, or putting a facade of the user in, interface, right? Just not the interaction part of it. And that's where, of course, you want to take external help. Our approach was we would take our first pass in terms of just wireframes, just ourselves, think about what that interaction should be. And then we did have interns initially when we were low on budget. Eventually, of course, we got a little more seasoned UX practitioners to help us out, validate things, probably challenge us in terms of why it shouldn't be the other way. But I would say largely for a 0 to 1 journey for our product, it was largely founder-led design, at least the first cut of it. And of course, the cosmetic part of it will be done by experts out there. But the interaction has to be owned by the product or the founders. But right now we're at a stage where we have an in-house UX designer, a product designer, and that's where we feel this is the right moment for the product, as it's already has like a baseline. It already has some critical mass for a professional to take it further, because they understand what is the core, what are the core design principles, and how the platform should kind of spread out, keeping in mind some of the constraints that we want to always live with, be it minimalism, be it, three click kind of a trigger for creating any kind of an output. So I think now we're transitioning to more of like experts, but earlier it was very much founder led.
Got it. And so then let's talk then about the staff that you surround yourself with. We're also a remote organization, though I agree with you. I remember the days being in an office and the value of being face to face. And so we also seek to get together at least once a year. But more broadly, how do you think about attracting and retaining great staff?
That's one of the most important, like, it's not a decision, like it's on a day-to-day basis that you need to take the right actions, right? Are we first building the right culture, giving everybody a voice, giving them the right recognition, helping them chart out a trajectory where they see that kind of growth? Because, see, I think everybody's left very good high-paying jobs, or at least with more credible firms, and making a bet with a startup like ours when we kind of got them in. So there's definitely that excitement, but there's also this level of nervousness that whether this will work. So having the right energy, that motivation is extremely critical to retaining that talent. What we believe is a very interesting time to be, building businesses. And that's because the roles itself are getting morphed, right? Because now we have AI agents that can do a lot of the things. And again, I'm not one of those who's trying to say that, AI SDRs are going to replace the whole need of sales or account executives. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But I think taking up 30, 40% of workload across tasks is definitely a reality we're seeing right now, both internally and with some of the network and partners that we have. Why do I call that out is because from a company culture perspective, now you can build teams which can be fairly lean. And when you're talking about lean teams, you now have the luxury to just hire A players. And those A players can be generalists to kind of start with in the journey where we are in. And eventually those can take up specialized roles, right? We had our first business hire or a non-technical hire who helped me in business development and sales enablement initially. And then into account management, so it's, helped me kind of set up these functions from scratch, from sales enablement to account management to customer success, now leading go-to-market. So the same person can wear multiple hats at the same point in time. Your account executive and account management, for example, can merge together. Your account manager and solution engineer roles can be merged together. So it's thanks to A, definitely because of AI agents, tech. Second, it helps us having a talent pool which is virtual, but it unlocks that possibility for giving our early employees that opportunity to do much more than rather than being pigeonholed into one particular domain, and that is what they love. So I think just giving them that opportunity to try out different things, wear multiple hats, have ownership of it, and then giving them a trajectory to grow is really what I think is critical for us to retain talent and attract. And I think you build credibility over a period of time. I think for us to attract talent initially, when we were like really small, probably just 6 months old, it wasn't very easy. But after having closed some great customers, having some great logos, raised some funding, that certainly helps. But nothing replaces the the primary experience that people have with the culture, right? And there's nobody else than existing employees who talk about, highly of the firm or the team or the leadership team that helps us attract that talent. So I think it's a mix of both being very deliberate about how do you design your organization in an AI new world, where jobs are getting leaner, the teams are getting leaner, cross-functional roles can be handled by a single person. And then, of course, that element of culture and transparency and, just being very bold and candid, that, people appreciate. So I think transparency, being candid, whatever's working, not working, being very upfront about our metrics, showing them, when things get ugly. I think many of the Gen Zs are very mature than what I used to be as a millennial. And I think that's definitely working out fine for us so far.
And what's your philosophy when there isn't a fit?
Yeah. This is something I've had to acquire as a skill. In my past life, it was very rare that I would have to fire people, right? It's difficult. And in larger corporates, you can probably get away by delaying those things or not being around by the time the decision has to be taken. So I came with that baggage of, from that corporate kind of a culture. But soon, the moment you're thrown into a startup, in terms of having that performance, having that high ownership mentality, one also has to be very much comfortable with taking hard decisions, right? So if things are not working out, we feel that in a startup world, typically 1 to 2 months is enough time for you to gauge whether the person is going to be a right fit or not. If they're owning up, they have the right work ethic, if the right energy, you will get that sense within definitely first couple of months. If And what we do is, if we think things are not working out, we will still give an opportunity in terms of a performance improvement plan. But I think after that third month or something, we are pretty sure that it's not in the best interest for both the candidate and ourselves to, have us and them hurting both for a long period of time. And it's best to kind of, part ways. And one has to be very rational and objective, not just because of performance, but you also have to take into account that if some resource is not working out and things are not, not up to the mark, that also impacts negatively the morale of the rest of the team members who are putting in all the effort. So for you, waiting too long is actually going to be very detrimental to your own organization, to the whole culture of the fabric. And of course, the candidate who, could probably just find a better fit. Like, we don't believe that, people are not good, right? Or they don't have the acumen. We believe that it's not the right place or the right fitment at the right point in time. We probably would have definitely seen something right during the interview process. But if things don't work out, it's probably that this particular culture or this particular way of doing things or this industry fitment was just not the right calling for that resource. So that's been our philosophy. But definitely getting very pragmatic about letting people go where we need to. Honestly, we've had 0% voluntary attrition so far, because those who come in and like it, they've been really enjoying it. We've had folks working with us for the last 2.5 years and still very much excited, asking us that we would want some more equity in the firm, which is a very good sign for me as a founder to hear. Yeah.
Fantastic. Love it. So let's talk about equity and your financing experience. What's it been?
Yeah. So Volcano, when we started, we were kind of bootstrapped. For the first 6 to 8 months, we built an MVP. We actually sold it to a couple of clients, and we had a decently working product before we went for a pre-seed round. Our pre-seed was in 2022. It was the peak of funding winter, so
Yeah.
it wasn't very pleasant experience. There never is any fundraising for founders, at least among all of the friends, founder friends that I have. But I think it was prolonged because of the funding winter. It took us about 4 to 5 months, but we were very fortunate that ultimately the first check writer was someone who didn't even see the pitch deck. He was a builder himself. Was building. He's the creator of Baby AGI, Yohei Nakajima, and he saw the platform. He saw the middleware and the full stack that we have built up, and he realized that this is just not another wrapper company that I'm talking to. They have something meaningful, and he wrote the first check, and that's when everybody else kind of followed, right? So I think getting to that first check was definitely a bit of a issue during that time. We did a second round, our seed round, which we concluded in August last year. So it's just been 12 months since our last fundraise. We raised $4 million in that round. And this time we definitely had better traction, good logos to kind of prove what the platform is and what our vision is. But across both of these fundraisers, to be very candid, both of us as co-founders come with a lot of domain experience and technical experience, but being based in Seattle, not in the Valley or New York, not coming with an ex DeepMind or OpenAI kind of a background or just the big tech background as one would expect, definitely did not help us in terms of accelerating those conversations with some of the other VC firms. But we have no regrets, but because we found some great partners, it was worth the wait. We've had Array Ventures, Geek Ventures, Rebellion, KPMG Ventures being some of our investors now. And it's been a fantastic ride with them, all through the pre-seed investors to now the seed investors. The kind of support they've offered us, both in terms of introductions to product feedback, to go-to-market support has been just phenomenal. So I would say the fundraising journey itself was very painful. But I think once you cross that, I think it's been a fun ride for us and very, very comfortable, candid, open with our investors who've been hands off when they need to be, and obviously providing, extending that guidance when they want to, which has been working out pretty well.
Did you and your co-founder have an idea as to what it was that you valued most besides the capital? going into these conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's difficult to put it in words, right? But I think when you're looking, when you're getting an investor, it's almost like a marriage, right? So can these firms kind of stay strong and stay put with us and, you know, back us when we are, you know, probably going to have like a tough time? That was actually our criteria, right? One could say that, hey, are you going to provide value add beyond the capital? You know, in terms of support and guidance and intros, we expect that that's actually become table stakes now for investors. It's for everybody that it kind of makes sense. But I think what really was critical for us is that can we sense that particular alignment with them, where we believe that they will be supportive of us during the bad times as well, back us. And I think that really shows character. Right. And I think we've done a good job in terms of evaluating it. It's one of those touchy-feely, softer aspects, which is difficult to gauge in just one conversation. So that's why we ourselves took our time to have multiple conversations, ask them those difficult questions, what they would do in these scenarios. And they were very forthcoming. And I think we found the right partners in that way. So I think it was that when all things are going bad, who's going to be backing you was our second most important metric just beyond the capital.
I love it. That's great. And the fact that you knew that ahead of time, brilliant. So capital's in the door. Time to cast a budget. How do you think about allocating capital between product development and sales and marketing?
Wow, pretty much every day of my life is like, you know, grappling through this question, through micro decisions on a day-to-day basis, whether it's hiring, whether it's investing on tools and so on. We are of a firm opinion that at the journey we're in terms of AI, since things are moving so fast, you have new models coming up every couple of weeks. The new products coming up, new business models emerging. For you to differentiate yourself, there is no other way but to build an excellent product. And for that, we need to have a very good product velocity so that we keep on shipping great features, add value, have those feedback loops with the customers. So still a large portion of our spend budget goes into product. And I think that's definitely heavily skewed in favor of product, because if the product is there, our sales reps can go there and sell. Because and if you don't believe in the product, if it's not the best, then you know, you can just get lost in all the clutter of hundreds of other startups that keep coming up every day. So that's been our philosophy. Will that change? Yes. I think right now we're at that journey where we still feel about 6 to 8 months is where we can still go very aggressive only on product. We've been lucky to get a lot of inbound word of mouth referrals through for customers. So that way we still have a little bit of luxury to over invest on product for the next few months. But I think as we think about scaling up beyond that, it'll probably get skewed for go to market and distribution. Yeah, so that's the current thinking.
And so, without revealing any trade secrets, how are you thinking about distribution?
Sure. So we target private equity, venture capital, sell side M&A, and consulting firms as a four primary target segments. And among all of them, one thing is common, which is private market oriented research and analysis. So the motions for go to market are slightly different for each of these different personas. For VCs, you can attract them through a lot of online or digital presence on LinkedIn or X because they're more tech savvy. But you're not going to find much luck with you know, old school investment bankers or private equity funds who would, you know, who you would rather meet in person in events. And then there are consulting firms who are also a segment, right? So there we have a few partnerships where we have a few communities of consulting members which has been helping us get a few leads. We are working on a few reseller and solution partnership programs for indirect route for more of long tail attainment of you know, certain segments. And then, of course, we have the traditional digital means of you know, sponsored ads, the classic content marketing, and so on for our customers. So what we are currently architecting as a go-to-market is a mix of direct sales heavy channel for most of our customer segments, and with 20% allocation to channel, which will be through partnerships, reseller and managed services programs, through other consulting firms, or just ISVs.
Love it. That's great. Well, I wish you a tremendous amount of success. And full disclosure for benefit of our audience, I'm really excited to have Sid on because we recently re wrapped up our own due diligence of products in the marketplace, and lo and behold, we ended up choosing Wokelo. And while our journey is just beginning, everything I've heard from the team is nothing but positive. So really, really excited for you, Sid. Before we wrap up, lessons learned. As you reflect back on the last few decades, what are some of the key takeaways that have really stuck with you, and that if you had a chance to go back and share them with yourself when you were first starting your career, what would they be?
Yeah, sure. I think one thing that particularly worked well for me, if I reflect back, was always trying to learn new things. Not being very constrained or pigeonholed into one segment. So I'm a mechanical engineer by training, and then even after my engineering, I learned coding just out of hobby. Took up a business analyst role in a consulting firm as my first job. So I was all over the place, but I think wherever I went, whether it was consulting or corp dev, I always tried to build solutions, use coding. And I think that curiosity has definitely helped me a lot. There's also that exposure element, right? So no matter where you start, right? I grew up in India, and of course worked my way through to get like good business schools there. But you still will have a, exposure gap with someone who's in the Bay Area, versus, let's say, even in Kansas City, right? For example, how do you bridge that gap? And, earlier it was a lot more tougher. Now, because of proliferation of tools and internet and AI, of course, it's become a lot more easier. But I think what I'm getting to is your ability to learn, your ability to be adaptive, your curiosity, your awareness in terms of bridging an exposure gap is super important. Right now, although I would love to kind of follow through a lot of podcasts and industry expert interviews and whatnot, right now as a founder of a tech startup, we really don't have the time. It's good that I got my dose of all podcasts, back in the day, even while I was doing consulting. So I think that helped me, going through Y Combinator videos just as a pastime was super helpful. So I think those are a couple of positive things that I did, which I feel reflecting back, have definitely helped me while running a startup or starting a startup. Few things that I haven't, which are probably lessons learned through failures, is definitely your ability to kind of multitask. Right. In terms of being very well organized, being very disciplined, and being able to multitask comes naturally to some, doesn't come naturally to many, and I'm one of them. But it can be acquired, and I think that needs a little bit of training and self-awareness, and that's what I lacked. But if you're a founder, if you're a CEO, you will have to. And I'm, Christian, I'm sure you probably go through this too. Like, so many things, you get hit from all different directions and all different domains. How do you make sense of that? That took me some time to get used to, right? It didn't come very naturally to me. And had I worked in that direction, in my past life, I think that would have served me better. But those are a few reflections.
I think your assessment's spot on. I mean, there's more things to do than there is time, and I think therein lies one of the key elements of any leader's success, is being able to separate the wheat from the chaff and decide, what's the priority. And I forget his name, but I recently heard a clip when someone was talking about being addicted to discipline, and I liked how he framed it. Because I think everyone agrees, getting done what needs to be done, regardless of how you feel, is, I mean, it's key to success. But really embracing it and not treating it as something that's negative, but positive. I agree. I wish I would have done that when I was much younger. Sid, before we wrap up, Anyone in your personal or professional life that you'd love to give a shout out to who's had a meaningful and positive impact on your career?
Well, so many, definitely family, my spouse, in terms of, just showing that courage to, take that plunge into building a startup, right? But I think if I were to give a shout out to one person, that would be my co-founder, Shashwat. I think being a two big only two co-founders, that brings up a lot of load, and just to get that right alignment, the right person, trusting each other, having that right moral compass, right? The straight moral compass. I couldn't have been more luckier, right? Someone who's more intelligent than me, has a better business acumen, is technically gifted. I always try to hire people who are smarter than me, but I got a co-founder who's like just been exceptional. So I think he's one who's probably behind the scenes all the time as a CTO, doing all the hard work. And I myself at times would be participating in events and conferences as a CEO, getting some of the limelight, but it wouldn't have been without him. So yeah, a lot of credit goes to him.
And how do you pronounce his name again?
His name is Shashwat.
Shashvat. Well, shout out to Shashvat for helping bring Wokolo to life and the success that you've had. If there are any members of our audience who would love to learn more about Wokolo, get in touch with you, how can they find you?
Absolutely. If you're looking for any investment research, automation help, or building agents for yourself, please come visit us at www.vokelo.ai. That's Wokelo.ai. Or reach me directly at sid@vokelo.ai.
Fantastic. Again, for the benefit of our audience, Sid Mason, co-founder and CEO of Wokolo AI. Sid, thank you for joining us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Christian, it was a pleasure chatting. Thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure. And until next time, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.